Welcome back to the No One Fights Alone podcast. Your hosts, Max Morgan and Brad Shepherd. What's up, brother?
What's going on, buddy? How are you?
Happy anniversary.
Thank you. Yeah, 29 years today. Holy cow. I guess that's a good start. Guess I'll stick with it.
So today being March 28, we'll probably release this podcast later, but man, sincerely, happy anniversary. You, yeah, Becky's amazing. You, such a great couple, great kids. Been through a lot and standing the ground. It's just amazing to watch a marriage be successful like that. Been through some shit.
I'm proud of where we're at. It's not easy for sure. And you know, we've had our share of trials and whatnot, but definitely worth it. And yeah, it's a good start. I think she might keep me around a little bit longer. We'll see.
Yeah, for sure. Well, it's fun to watch that as my two boys, you know, are one of them newly married and one of them probably, I foresee that in the near future. It's fun to see people hanging on to it. To you, congratulations, Max, to our listeners, speaking on behalf of them as well. Happy anniversary, bro. We got a great podcast today, man.
Dude, it was awesome. Like, I couldn't believe, like, all of a sudden, how far we were into it. I looked at the timer and I'm like, holy cow.
Yeah, you know, for the listeners.
Flew by.
Yeah, for the listeners, I would just say, if you're looking at the length of it, just hit play. I think you'll find the conversation really fascinating. I felt the same. It just flew by.
Yeah. And it's a topic that I love, something that I've wanted to know more about, something I've been interested in incorporating, you know, in my own daily routine, my own life. So, man, I loved every bit of it.
So coming on is Josh Grandinetti, a firefighter, but really a guy who's been through some shit and found that mindfulness meditation practices helped him tremendously. Man, he just has such a way of unpacking what it is and how to do it. So simple.
Yeah.
Because I know for me personally, early on, I tried to make it hard and tried to mess it up and tried to make it complicated. And it just isn't. It isn't that hard.
He made it, you know, he kind of broke it down into the ABCs of it. You know what I mean? How simple, it's hard, but how simple it can be. And you know, the actual implementing it's not hard at all.
For sure. Well, I think for our listeners, I would also say, you know, lean into this one, turn it up a little bit. If you're driving down the road or if you're sitting at home with it playing in the background, turn it up a little bit. This is a good one. I feel like nearly all of them are so good. We have such good people coming on the podcast and very humble in this, because we're just, you know, we're two idiots sitting over here trying to muddle through a podcast host. But man, we have some great people on, and this one's no different. We spend some time talking about how this helps and why it's so beneficial to our health, and really, really some great conversation.
Yep. I loved it.
Well, folks, hang in there. Josh Grandinetti. Here we go.
Welcome to the No One Fights Alone podcast. This podcast is dedicated to mental wellness for first responders and beyond. Through powerful stories, personal experiences, and expert insights, we explore the challenges and triumphs of maintaining resilience in the face of adversity. Together, we remind you, no one fights alone.
Hey, folks, we have Josh Grandinetti with us today on the No One Fights Alone podcast. Josh, thanks for coming on with us.
Hey, thanks for having me on, guys. I appreciate the opportunity.
I'm really looking forward to this conversation. I don't think we have people come on and talk about this self-care type resource and tool enough, which is mindfulness and meditation. So I'm really looking forward to this today, and I really am thankful for you taking the time to come on and join us and have a discussion. So Josh is a 15-plus year firefighter and the founder of Foundation Fortified, which we're going to learn more about here in just a little bit. But before we kind of get to that mindfulness and meditation portion of our conversation, there's obviously a reason why you're so passionate about this. Why don't you take us on a little story time for how you got and developed this passion for doing what you do?
Yeah, that sounds great. You know, about halfway through my career, like you said, I've been a firefighter for about 15 years or so. And about halfway through my career, I just became fairly anxious. You know, I I couldn't be at Walmart without hearing somebody's phone and kind of jump. You know, I began to see emergencies all throughout my personal life and even in my professional life when the dispatch tones weren't going off, right? I had to fix everything in my path. And someone kind of suggested to me that, you know, maybe everything doesn't need fixing. Maybe the way you see it needs to change. And, you know, they mentioned mindfulness to me. And I remember early in my training as a firefighter, we were always cautioned about the poor coping mechanisms that we're also, you know, at higher risk for, like, you know, alcohol, drug use, substance abuse, you know, things of that nature, and to try to seek good coping mechanisms like physical fitness, you know, maybe hiking. And somewhere along that list was always this concept of mindfulness and meditation. And that just kind of always stuck with me as something interesting to look into maybe someday. And so when that gentleman suggested to me that my mind is what needed to change in relationship to my environment, that was really kind of the sticking point for me, saying maybe it's time to give it a shot. But, you know, when I first wanted to start practicing mindfulness and meditation, I didn't know where to go. I was kind of searching without a compass, you know. Where does anybody go?
Can I jump in here just for a minute? So
yeah.
I find that most, in my experience, most first responders aren't quite as open to that. That they're pretty close-minded to, I like to call this hippie shit. Matter of fact, I think on the phone we were talking about, this is a lot of hippie shit stuff, but it works. But most first responders, did you feel that? Did you have this sense of, what are you talking about, man?
Yeah, I think I totally agree with what you said there. I suffer from the same disillusions with mindfulness meditation that many people still do. You know, there's first of all, just this imaginary tale that we believe we need to, you know, shave our heads. So Max, off to a good start over there.
You're killing it, Max.
You know, we need to don orange robes.
To be a good example.
You know, we got to hike a mountain and we got to go sit, you know, with a Tibetan Lama for years on end before we can get any
eagle feather in our teeth, the whole thing. Yeah. Yeah,
exactly. You know, this is what we need to do if we're going to be meditators, you know, be contemplative practitioners, but this just isn't true. And, you know, then there's that other level where you kind of start to think the hippie crowd, right? The kind of the people that don't get things done, the people who just want to sit around all day and just kind of love and prosper and, you know, without any of the work to keep society going, right? So that's like the next level of kind of bad information about meditation. And what I've tried to do with Foundation Fortified is just save the baby in that bathwater and cut out all the religious dogmatism, cut out all the strangeness that you might find in practice, and just stick with what a rigid, scientific, evidence-based mindfulness practice is meant to do for the brain, what it's meant to do for the body, how you practice it, how you develop it, and all the information along the way that we can now defend in the Western world as scientifically valuable.
But you see that now. You see that now clearly. I mean, the conversation on the phone was a real treat because you just have this calm about you, you know, when you're conversing, and obviously it's coming out now as well. But in that moment, back when you were hearing this, like what was going through your brain? Like most first responders, like, come on, man.
Yeah. You know, when I came to it, I was kind of ready to absorb whatever information I can get. Now, I did have several situations. You know, I tell a story. I showed up to this Facebook mindfulness group that was being held down the road on a Thursday evening. And so I drove over there and I had the uncomfortable situation of sitting amongst, you know, three computer salesmen and some plumbing guy. And they were all doing these weird chants. And I had to say these weird things and do strange motions, you know. And it was like, this is not what I'm looking for, right? This is what gives meditation and mindfulness a bad name. And I've also made the mistake as a meditation enthusiast, if you will, of trying to force the practice onto some of my counterparts. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like really try to get them to sit down in the gym and say, look, guys, this is going to change your life. Now just don't stop thinking about breathing. Just that's all you got to do, right? And I've had some misadventures there as well, but I like to think I've honed it a little bit better now.
So motivation by shame and guilt is not the best practice to get them to buy into meditation.
Yeah. Not the best one, no.
So let's go back to your career. So in building up to this, like, I mean, you obviously were carrying some stuff that was, you know, up to this point, you know, I'll use the word haunting or pervading and invading maybe your inner being, you know. Did you think it was a hard career? I mean, did you at that point you're like, man, I've been through some shit, or it's like, this is just part of it.
I think I had a mixed match of both. You know, I think like a lot of first responders, you'll get through a shift and just think, there's no way I'm going to be able to show up to the station again tomorrow.
Right? Yeah, yeah.
I mean, there's no way I can go through that again. And then there are plenty of other shifts where you just kind of, well, we got through the whole season of Call of Duty here. What are we going to do next tour? The video game's over, right? Like I've had both sides of that spectrum. And, but yeah, I think what I began to notice is just my mind was changing, just like that gentleman suggested to me, is, you know, when one thing I often talk about is this thing I called the responder feedback loop. Okay. And this is something that develops. It's something that comes on 10, 15 years into a career is, you know, when you first decide you want to become a first responder, you begin to train your mind to respond. Okay. And that's, you have to be able to respond to the needs of others over something as trivial as your own empty stomach or your own thirst or your own desire to finish watching a television show in order to be a good first responder, right? You have to be able to at least overcome those basic human selfish desires, right? Well, as you train yourself to respond over and over and over again over the course of 10 years, you know, neurons that fire together tend to wire together. And before we know it, we can either develop depression or isolation, anxiety that leads us to just kind of constantly be on that treadmill, constantly discharging our own stress, our own worries, our own anxieties onto the people that we care about. And it's through that process that I began to find myself unhappy and kind of began to derange my own kids. You know, I would hear my kids start screaming or whatever, or hear one of them fall down. And like a normal parent would just assume their kid fell down. But because of things I had seen throughout my career, I was imagining my child with a broken arm at best and with, you know, a worse traumatic scene than that. And this constant rumination and fear of what my kids might go through would animate me very much to go see if they were okay. And once I got there and saw that one of my kids just tripped, fell down, and is now kind of giggling about it, I would then get frustrated at my own kids. Like, why are you being so loud if you aren't as injured as I thought you were? You know, like you're only allowed to be as loud as you can to the injury status, you know? And it was just this mechanism of constantly forcing my career and the things I've seen onto myself and to my family and even to my crew that I just decided that something had to change in my mind. Something had to change in the way I relate to these imaginary scenarios that I create within my own mind. Does that make sense in any way?
Yeah. And I think we jump. I hate the part of the job that, because of what we've seen in the job, anything that happens in our personal life, we automatically jump to the very worst case scenario. You know what I mean? Because we've seen that happen in our job. And it's like, and so in our heads, we play it up to be so much worse than before we even know really what it is. And, you know, and it causes great anxiety. It causes stress. It causes all kinds of difficulties for us because we jump to that very worst case scenario.
Absolutely. Well, and it, you know, it kind of goes with every asset of being a first responder, whether you're a firefighter like myself, who's always been trained to get ahead of the incident even before you arrive. So I will start thinking worst case scenarios about what this dispatch might look like. And I might even send more resources going to it if I don't like what my dispatch is coming over with. Same thing for a police officer. You know, if you're responding to a domestic violence, you aren't going in there thinking, okay, it's most likely going to be, you know, just some fists and whatever. You begin thinking about the situation like we have a weapon on hand. You want to make sure, you want to know that immediately if there's a possibility, right? And we're constantly making the worst out of our common dispatches before we start regressing backwards and just deal with it as it comes, right? But that kind of constant amplifying our imagination for what we're responding to, we also do this in our personal lives, like you're saying. You know, we all of a sudden want to try to get ahead of the worst case scenario. So we almost imagine the worst case scenario first and begin backpedaling from there. And that's pretty dissatisfying. That's not a very comfortable way of going through life.
It's not an easy way to work backwards either. It's hard to, once you're amped up, and then to try and work backwards.
I find it interesting people talking about, they just leave it at the door. Like I just, you know, at the end of my shift, I just take it off, and you know, whether it's a cop, it's a firefighter, it's a paramedic, I'm like, I leave it at the door. I have never met the person that could leave it at the door. I've not met him. Like I've heard them say that. And then when you ask them a few questions, well, they're not sleeping. They're talking about being in hypervigilance, but you know, at some point, a little bit of a denial. But I just find it difficult for any first responder to detach from that And what you're describing is this non-detachment, like you become this person, this same person at home that you are at work. Mm-hmm. I mean, it permeates into us of this way of life, this philosophy on how we're going to see life. I used to use the metaphor of a lens, a set of glasses. You start to develop shades of lens by which you're seeing life through based upon your experiences. And it's I know it's that way with everyone, but it's compounded in this first responder space and veteran space because you're seeing a side of humanity that most people never see.
I agree with all of that, you know, and I think there's a lot of interesting threads to tug on in what you just said about mindfulness practice, but I'll take the first two there that I kind of noticed. And, you know, it's this idea of leaving things at the door, right? And when I began experimenting with mindfulness practice and kind of made it more of a habit, I did notice some interesting differences between who I am at home and who I am at the station, right? And the most interesting things about these changes were there are things that I couldn't control. They really weren't. So an example is what time I think about sleep. I mean, me and my wife are gassed after a couple episodes of, you know, whatever we're watching by 9:30, and we're ready to go to bed. But at the firehouse, I don't even begin thinking about sleep till about 1 in the morning. Yeah. You know, it's just, I just didn't. I would get hungry at different times, right? I would have different ideas of what my day is going to look like and how I'm going to achieve those goals, whether I was wearing navy blue or just a civilian shirt, right? And it just, the ways in which we fragment and change our life do tend to extrapolate based on our current environment, our current experiences, and the people that we're engaged with, right? And mindfulness can help break some of this down for you. However, you know, the changes that are happening to your brain are constant, right? This conversation is by definition changing all three of our brains to some degree and the brains of your listeners, okay? And when you are constantly running to people's emergencies, whether they're, you know, emergencies that are made up because these people are making bad decisions and we just have to babysit that situation, or if they're really, truly life-changing traumatic events that we're responding to, that's also going to change your brain. It's going to change the way your amygdala fires. It's going to change the way, you know, you feel anxiety throughout the rest of your life and through your day, just because you are constantly stimulating the parts of your brain that are responding to threat and responding to chaos. This is going to change your mind over time. So there's this difference between like acute and chronic stress that we as responders can kind of begin to hone into. And that difference is what accounts for the long-term changes and why it can be so difficult for first responders to get back to a life where they aren't constantly on edge and hypervigilant, because the brain structures in our heads do begin to change. Mindfulness practice can help reverse a lot of this through practice and through understanding what we're trying to achieve during our mindfulness sessions.
Was there anyone else, and kind of back to your story, talking back us up a little bit again, was there anybody else, spouse, kids, you know, in your support circle that was also nudging you and saying, man, that like you're a little off, you're a little edgy, your reactions are, you know, grandiose to the situation, you know, your emotional reaction doesn't match the situation. Any feedback from people around you as well, or were you just that self-aware?
Probably not so self-aware at the time. I definitely find that I'm more self-aware now than I used to be before discovering my meditation practice, but unfortunately, no. My wife and my children didn't really understand, you know, because we were young, you know, and I started having kids when I was 23, I think, with my wife. We had two boys. We were done by the time I was 25, and so we were just kind of growing up together, you know. So I was changing as fast as my wife was changing. My kids were growing up, but I did get to a point where I just felt extremely on edge at all times. And if it wasn't for a couple, like I said earlier, training in my career where mindfulness meditation was kind of suggested, and then just a pure dint of a conversation with a gentleman, I don't know if I would have found mindfulness meditation immediately available to me. It was just kind of through those two little mechanisms. I was always interested in the practice. I don't know if you guys remember that Rage Against the Machine album that had that monk that was engulfed in flames. I was staring at that album when I was a kid, just like super curious about what was going on in that picture, you know? So there were little steps along the way, but there definitely wasn't like, you know, something that made it immediately evident and available to me, which is a big reason why I started Foundation Fortified, was to build that system for first responders.
For sure.
So how far in your career were you when you was introduced to the mindfulness stuff and decided, hey, I need to take a look at this?
About 8-9 years is kind of when I started going on the personal journey to discover ways I could, you know, just frankly be happier, you know, just be a little bit less on edge all the time. And that's when I started kind of discovering Facebook groups and trying to find my way through it, downloading apps on my phone and things like that. And that was extremely helpful for sure. But there was very little out there to relate to a first responder in the lifestyle that I had chosen. You know, the constant difference in my changing environment between if I'm Josh Graninetti on this side or I'm Captain Graninetti on that side. You know, the difference between the two is immense. You know, we all pretend like we're the same person, and we are to some degree. Obviously, you're taking your brain and your organs with you, and obviously, you're taking your beliefs and everything with you. But there's no way you engage with the community in the same way you might engage with a friend who's acting in a similar way. You know, you couldn't. You couldn't behave in the same way you are with a friend who was, you know, drunk with his wife and being an idiot as you could with a citizen. You know, you have to act differently. And that difference in perception just goes to show your behaviors are changing with your environments and with your stimulus. You know, right now you're a police officer, you're representing, you know, the government, and you have to act in the way you've been trained. Whereas if it's your friend, you might just go up and hit him and ask him what the hell you're doing. You're going to ruin your life, right? So there's differences all the way along the path of who we are. And mindfulness meditation has definitely shown me a lot of that, but there was nothing that was immediately evident throughout my initial parts of my career.
I think before we really kind of deep dive some of the meditation and mindfulness stuff, there was two specific catchphrases when you and I talked on the phone before that just really I thought were powerful, and you brought one of them up already. One is that neurons that fire together wire together. What does that mean to you when you say it? What formulates in your brain and because you speak with a lot of passion in this, what drives that? Tell us a little bit more about that. I know a little bit about that neuroplasty rewiring, but I'm obviously no expert. But I think it would be great for the listeners to hear how and why this works, because we're not just victims to the way it is up there in our brain. We can change this.
Absolutely. Yeah, you know, the brain's an incredibly complicated organ, obviously, right? I mean, it was fairly intuitive when we first saw the first heart, what it was doing. You know, we could notice what it's doing in the chest. We can cut it open, see there's four chambers. Pretty quickly, we could tell what it was doing. The brain isn't so obvious, right? The brain is operated with only a couple different cells, ultimately, and a few hormones that act between our synapses, and it creates all of this reality and everything that we experience. And for a long time, scientists thought that there wasn't like a lot of change that was happening there. You know, you could just probe or prod or study the certain parts of the brain through imaging and see, okay, that part fires up when the person's angry or scared. This part fires up when they're having a pleasurable experience, yada, yada, right? But now we're beginning to just understand that the brain changes extremely rapidly, okay? And kind of like you were saying earlier, neurons that fire together, wire together, is a way of understanding what neuroplasticity means, okay? You can think of your neuronal wiring as a stream. Okay, if you only have a few experiences of, say, going to a movie theater with your family, let's say you've only done that once, you're going to have a very plotted memory, maybe 20 years down the road, of what a movie theater experience is like. But if I take you to a movie theater once every month as my child, and we go see whatever the hot new movie is, right, you're going to begin to just slowly erode away a stronger and stronger pathway through your mind. And when I ask you what a movie theater experience is like 20 years later, you're going to be able to walk me through a movie theater experience very clearly, because your brain has observed that environment. It's been in that environment. It's smelled the smells, right? Seen the sights, everything that's going on in that experience. And that's with just one experience, going to the movie theater. Well, we're constantly having experiences. And each experience is either feeding that neuronal plasticity, that riverbed of neuronal wiring, or it's not. It's just kind of either regressing or staying stable. Does that make sense? And that's the more of a single experience that we have, the more often you are charging that system throughout the brain, the stronger it's going to get like a muscle, and the more likely it is to win in the competing stimulus that's always going on in our minds. So in a given situation, if say you're staring at somebody who appears to be angry, well, if you grew up in a household full of angry people, angry and violent people, you're far more likely to be on the defense and be ready to react than somebody who grew up in a very loving household with smiling faces. You're going to actually be more trusting of that angry face. You're going to be less likely to respond with violence or defensive mechanisms just because of the amount of time your mind has been exposed to angry and violent situations. You, the individual that you take yourself to be, is going to respond differently. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it really does. I really want to draw out an important point here. We recently had, well, we've spoken to this a couple times actually within the last probably year on the neuron firing and the neuroplasty rewiring. The one that comes to mind immediately is Dr. Evan Peskin. Shout out to that podcast. It was really informative. It was actually a ketamine podcast, but he as a medical doctor and specializing in pain management. And we got to talking about neuroplasty rewiring. And I think, now this is my layman viewpoint on it. I'm obviously not a doctor, but and very, you know, layperson understanding of this, but we don't have to be stuck in this rut or victims to this is the way it's always going to be. And to the point, if I can use that metaphor of going to the movies, if we don't like going to, you know, putt-putt golf, and that because that elicits something negative, we can start rewiring our brain. I know we're using a very rudimentary illustration here, but if we're going to putt-putt golf all the time and it's not doing good for us, then we start going to the movie and we start forming a new rewiring of our brain. And the more we go to the movie, the less our brain is drawing us to going to putt-putt golf. But it has to be intentional. Absolutely. It has to be intentional of, I'm going to say no to putt-putt golf, and I'm going to say yes to going to the movie. And, you know, this with Dr. Peskin, we were talking about, you know, addictive personalities and stress and depression. And I mean, we were hitting a lot of things here, but I think this, it applies, all of this applies the same. Is that fair? Is that?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I completely believe that. You know, I think one of the things that the meditation community is trying to do is bring it more forward as something to be understood as a actual practice, a skill we're developing, not a religion.
Absolutely.
Does that make sense? So I'm, you know, the more we can bring science and doctors into the mix, the better. I mean, it's becoming more and more of a clinician's toolbox as well. As far as psychedelics and ketamine, you know, go and rewiring the brain, that's what makes them so valuable for health studies anymore. For a long time, we weren't able to study these compounds because of the drugs, and, you know, people were very hyper aware of drugs in the community for a long time. So they cut off all funding to a lot of these compounds. But, you know, what a psychedelic does is it comes online into the brain and just allows for quick, rapid rewiring of neuronal tissue. You know, it does this very quickly over the course of a few hours. And that's why people can have very extreme experiences, start to relate to their lives and their memories in a different way because of this hyper-streaming effect that a psychedelic will have. You know, there's a meditation instructor that I've followed for some time now. His name is Sam Harris. And he says something like, psychedelics are like strapping yourself to a rocket, okay? You're going to have an experience, right? It's going to take you somewhere. Whereas, you know, meditation is more like raising a sail in a sailboat. It's very slow. It's very deliberate. But you're more likely to go in the direction that you are trying to go rather than going off into a bad trip or a blissful trip or, you know, a difficult one, right? That's what a psychedelic might do for us. But meditation is more like just raising a sail in an ocean and just cutting.
It's very intentional.
I like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, let's dive into that a little bit. Benefits. I think if I categorize this a little bit and talking about meditation and mindfulness, I think the cell obviously would be benefits, and the, you know, one of the things that I want us to definitely talk about is the practice of it. What is it? What does it do? But I want to key in on something you just said there as I'm reflecting on that last little bit. I think there is a little bit of apprehension based upon this being some type of religion or cultish appearance. And like, that's, well, it's one of the reasons I call it some hippie shit. I mean, it right. Because it has arguably a stigma to it that is, man, I wouldn't get caught dead, you know, doing some kumbaya shit, you know, and look at me now. You know, this is where we're at. So any thoughts on that? I mean, of people you've encountered or naysayers, or just what's your words back to people when they offer that up? I'm sure they don't say it like that or ate it, you know, fuck that.
Oh, they do.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
they do. So, you know, I was one of these people as well. I mean, you know, I would cringe at even the word meditation just sounded strange to me, you know, and I just didn't understand it. It seemed like a waste of time. It seemed like a very self-indulgent thing to be doing. It seemed like, you know, with all these problems in the world, how can you just sit there and wish people good fortune? Why don't you get out there and do something about it? Right? I was one of these people. But again, there's just so many misconceptions to what a meditation or a mindfulness practice needs to be. Okay. But we can relate it back to physical fitness in a very easy way. I mean, it was 100 years ago, you wouldn't be caught dead just lifting a heavy rock and putting it down 20 times in a row, you know, walking in a giant ever-growing circle while you rest just to go back to the rock and do it another, you know, 20 times. Physical fitness just wasn't common. We all had very labor-intensive jobs. We were all farmers or industrial or whatever we were doing. So physical fitness was just part of life for the longest time in human history. So, you know, going to a gym to exercise was very bizarre. It didn't make any sense. But now it's part of so much of our lives because it's good for our benefits. It's good for our health. You know, I have no doubt that people back when we were hunters and gatherers were probably much more mindful than the average person is today. You know, these days, so many things are constantly competing for our attention. Okay. There's a major war out for our attention anymore. And if your listeners are unaware, I mean, everything that we're getting for free on our cell phones makes you the commodity. And the more addicting and the more time and engagement you can get into your cell phones, the more I'm, by simple mathematics, going to extract money out of you. This is why we always have Amazon boxes at our front door anymore. You know, we've come to find out that selling you something is secondary to keeping you hooked on something. Human attention really is the gold mine of our age. And so many of us are fracturing it in so many different directions. You know, very few of us have strong powers of attention anymore. We're kind of training our minds to have the attention spans of a goldfish. I mean, every video reel is about 10 seconds, and most people can barely get through one of those without just flipping to the next thing until something exciting enough. Yeah, until something exciting enough will hold your attention, right? And if you really want to understand your mind, using social media is a great way to do it. I mean, just look at the content that's coming over your social media. That will reflect back to you the image of what you spend your time thinking about and engaged with for probably what do those cell phone notifications on Saturday say? About 3 to 4 hours a day is common for people. We all ignore that. We all ignore that notification that says you spent 2 hours and 57 minutes per day on this device this week. Think about, I mean, what kind of life is that, right? What did you get out of that 2.5 hours every day? So one of the biggest benefits for mindfulness practice is just training your attention, just being able to sit with your eyes closed for 10 minutes at a time and focus your awareness on a single stimulus can get some of this attention back. I mean, if you want to talk about part of the reason we're having issues in our industry these days, it's because even our leaders don't have strong powers of attention anymore. When they're on their off days, I guarantee you they're just as stuck in their cell phones as the kid who's 20 years old is now. We like to pretend, you know, we like to tell ourselves, oh, those kids spend so much time on your phone. What does your screen time notification say?
Oh, yeah.
Show me that right now. What does that say? You know, and we're all in this predicament because technology has just gotten so addictive and so interesting and so fun anymore that we're beginning to fracture along the seams in our minds. And one of the biggest benefits from mindfulness meditation is training your attention again. And in doing so, giving the people you care about the best gift you can give them, your actual felt attention. You know, we all know what it's like to be talking to an individual who's, you know, looking at something else right now, or, you know, texting with a friend, or, you know, kind of giving you half of their attention. And then we also know what it's like to really sit there with grandma while she looks deep into your eyes, right? And she listens to every grade you got that week, and she is very engaged with who your friends are. And we all have memories like that of our grandmother or grandparent who is just really engaged with us. But we can all train that level of attention and then give it to the people that we care about, to our communities that we serve and protect, because you've trained that level of attention to a degree that people can actually feel your presence You know, it is not only a benefit to you, but it's a benefit to everyone around you. So that's one small benefit.
It's so interesting on the attention span, because you talk about, you know, well, your screen time and whatever, but then how many times when you're on social media and somebody's got a big long post, well, that's too long to pay attention to that. So, I mean, you're going to skip to the next thing. You know what I mean? If it's about this long, I'll read it. But if it's that long, you know what I mean? And I got to scroll through four pages of this.
Yeah, I don't have time for that, but I'm going to spend another hour
for that. Yeah. I don't have the time for that, because I've got more scrolling to do.
It's fascinating, you know, and we're all victims of it. And, you know, one person's ability to abstain from it and another person's ability to get totally hooked by it, you know, has a lot to do with how addictive the apps they've downloaded their phone are and what it is that this person's trying to get out of their life. But we all know what it's like to be able to succumb to this level of fractured attention. I mean, most of us can't even be at a doctor's office and just sit there and be in the room without grabbing our phones to distract ourselves from that situation. I mean, being alone with our own minds and our own thoughts is so disrupting to so many of us that we'll reach for almost anything to distract ourselves. So, I mean, if you want to master your mind, if you want to understand who you are and you want to gain a level of control over your impulses, there's no better way to do it than to practice mindfulness.
And I would say that, like, probably 99% of the people will tell you that they either went on a vacation or they went somewhere up the mountains or on a cruise or something, didn't have any cell phone service, nothing, and how nice it was. Mm-hmm. How nice it was to just not have any of that. But we don't do that at home.
No, not at all. Not in least bit.
That's if you don't take the kids.
That's right.
Well, let's, you brought up the benefits. What, give us the benefits of practicing this on a daily basis.
You know, pinning down, there are the rigid scientific evidence-based benefits that we could talk about, right? Like reductions in anxiety, you know, better control over your emotional states, better sleep, okay? Less overall on dissatisfaction with your life outcome and your life circumstance. You know, these are all very rigid, scientifically defensible positions at this point. But, you know, the real benefits of mindfulness meditation is really unlimited, you know, and it you can truly sense what it feels like to love another person unconditionally if you get to certain levels of loving kindness practice. Okay. There are individuals who can go and be mindful in a cave for 10 plus years and be isolated from the world and, you know, take on that insane proposition of a life in order to gain deeper understanding of what it means to be even alive, right? I mean, the difference in what you can achieve through mindfulness practice is pretty wide ranging, but there are so many small benefits that can come at us with just 5 or 10 minutes a day, right? We don't need to find ourselves on the cushion for an hour a day, rigidly trying to do this practice. You know, just a simple 5 or 10 minutes every other day can really enhance a lot of different factors of our lives. So, you know, your patience will tend to increase dramatically. When you first start meditating, you're going to discover that you just kind of want this thing to be over. I'm going to do this, you know, I'm going to try. And these 10 minutes feel every bit of 10 minutes, right? And you'll first start to notice your impulse to just want this to be over. And that's already you being tested with your patience. It's just you and your mind. And this frustrated experience of wanting to get up and go do something rather than do nothing already begins to train you as a person, okay? There are so many ways in which, as your impulses arise through your meditation practice, as different emotions arise through your meditation practice, you're going to be challenged with everything that's coming into your awareness and to kind of grapple with it. You know, why might one person experience very deep sadness constantly throughout their meditation practice, where I, you know, kind of an anxiety bunny, I'm constantly being pulled to get up and move and go do something and go achieve something, right? That's something I deal with almost every single time I sit, is sitting with anxiety. But the key to meditation practice isn't getting rid of any of the stimulus in our minds or in our bodies. It's allowing it to happen and actually feeling what it feels like to be anxious or to be depressed or to, you know, suffer from a bad memory or a bad traumatic experience. You know, if you're being mindful and, you know, your meditation coach tells you to focus on the breath, and you're a paramedic who just got off shift and watched somebody take their last few breaths, that might be a moment of anxiety trauma, you know, you might start to work through just that call right there. And the key isn't to push it away. You know, that's what we do in our normal lives all the time, is we reach for things that we like and we grasp onto them, and we try to protect them from changing or ever getting out of our hands, right? And then we push away everything that we don't like. You know, we avoid everything that makes us feel uncomfortable inside. But in mindfulness meditation, you're not trying to grasp on to anything that's pleasurable. You just allow it to happen. And in the same way, if something unpleasurable, a pain in the back or a discomforting memory or emotion, you just actually try to bore into what that feels like in the mind and watch it dissipate without you having to attach and do something with those thoughts or emotions. You know, they're kind of like clouds that just pass through the sky. But what we try to do in our normal lives when we experience a certain emotion or thought is we try to take that cloud and tie it to the ground somehow. You know, we take that thought and we make that thought or emotion who we are. We make it part of our day. Whereas if you just let go and give up on that entire journey, you just watch these clouds pass through the mind unbothered and untempted to do anything about them.
My personal perspective on that, whereas I'm on this side of, you know, in recovery and practicing this pretty common and at various stages of either my anxiousness or, you know, PTSD, I'll call on a meditation practice pretty quickly. And it's not anything fabulous or fantastic. It could be me sitting in my truck, just, you know, being the practice of presence. And I hope we go into a little bit of you walking through what a practice looks like, but it's, I don't try to be the Zen doctor on this. I just try to be me. And one of the things that I found in this is that I now can much easily and quickly identify what the emotion is that's driving the train, the crazy train, if you will, instead of this pushing back or ignoring or just increasing in my busyness so that I don't have to deal with it. Whatever's coming up feels like vomit in my throat. And, you know, if I work faster, harder, and do something more, or social media scroll quickly, then I can make sure that goes back down. And instead, give it opportunity to linger there a minute and say, okay, that's fear, or that's sadness, or that's, you know, it's, you know, maybe it's distrust or lack of hope, something that, okay, that's out of my control. You know, I'm a 12-step recovery guy. So I, you know, it becomes a matter of surrender at that point for me. And like, that's outside of my control. I'm going to surrender that to my higher power and, you know, do a little work, find hope, find peace, and go through the day. But I found, to my, you know, the point I was trying to make there, I found that it began to be easier to identify what was really driving that or pushing a button, if you will. Thoughts on that?
Yeah, I'll touch on it real quick. And I know Max has a question there, but yeah, I can tell you a little bit of my own personal experience. So, you know, if you would have met me even, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, you might have thought I was a little bit more of an angry person than I actually would want to identify myself as. I didn't feel like I was a very angry person inside. Anger never seemed to make sense to me, but I'm forced to admit, I understand why people would think that. You know, I always had a negative view. I was always kind of talk with my hands as the Italian that I am. You know, I would frown my burro and I would kind of talk with a little bit of emphasis in my words. But when I first started being mindful and I started practicing my meditation, I began to uncover that that wasn't anger all along. I was just anxious. And it was all the attempts to, you know, deal with the anxiety in the body language and the emphasis in my voice and the way I would move and talk. You know, it was all a way of kind of discharging this constant eruption of anxiety that was going on in my mind, okay? And once I could identify as anxiety, you know, that made a little bit of self-compassion easier for me.
Yeah.
You know, I began to feel a little sorry for myself in a way. And you know, that sense is going to strike your listeners a little strangely, but let me hit it a little bit differently, right? Here I am trying to maintain self-esteem, right? We always tell our kids having high self-esteem is a good thing. But what do we do in order to achieve high self-esteem? We constantly judge other people and compare them to ourselves. And that's our grade as to whether or not we're good enough. And that's what self-esteem gets you, is a constant judgment and a constant comparing yourself, playing status games in society. And every time you reach a new status level, the only thing you care about is the next status level above that. Whereas self-compassion isn't the need to compare yourself to others. It's just the understanding of common humanity that you are in this situation, and it's okay to feel the emotions and the struggle that you're having. Now, that doesn't mean that you don't want to do everything you can for your part of being self-compassionate is trying to alleviate that for yourself. So a true practitioner of self-compassion will tell you that it's not very compassionate to reach for that next bottle of alcohol, but it is very compassionate over time to deal with the struggles that are causing you to reach for that bottle, to go and uncover some of the harm that has been done to you, some of the bad impulses that you're stuck with. That's what a good self-compassion practice will allow you to do, is see what you are, see who you are, and then want to alleviate that suffering in yourself. And so once I was able to make the jump from anger to anxiety to self-compassion, then some of these, the way in which I dealt with my emotions, I dealt with my anxiety, was just allowing it to come on and walk through that process and just sit with the anxiety. Notice how it feels in the mind. Notice what sensations it comes up in the body. And just watch these things pass away. Now, they might come up just as quickly as they left, but just allowing this process in the mind throughout meditation practice, whether it's anxiety or depression, post-traumatic stress, or just everyday struggles that human beings have, this is the practice, is constantly noticing what's coming up in the mind, bringing the mind back to either the breath or some other stimulus, being openly aware, and just practicing this over and over again so that you can begin to be less associated with it, be less stricken by it every time it erupts, if that makes sense.
Great point.
No, I like that. And I love the conversation. For not just myself, but also for the listeners, what is a daily routine of Josh Grandinetti? I mean, how does this meditation get put into practice? And what are you doing? What is your daily routine, you know, on a daily basis?
That's great. Me and my wife, you know, we usually wake up around 5 and we hit the gym early. You know, we got 2 boys. We have a 12-year-old and a 10-year-old. Yeah, we got a big scary dog that will escape out of the house at 5 o'clock, get the gym done, leave our kids sleeping, get home and get our day going, right? I'll either go to the fire station or whatever. But as far as incorporating a mindfulness and meditation practice, you know, it's often helpful to start at the same time every day, whether you want to do your meditation in the morning or in the evening, or carve some time out in the afternoon. You know, when you're starting, it's very beneficial to choose the same time of day. I think over time, it's important to get out of these associations because they just become more distractions for us in our meditation practice. That might be a much larger discussion than we want to have here today, but it is helpful to ground yourself to the practice in some way. Now, the way we build habits as humans is by picking a time and just doing the thing until it becomes normal and regular in our daytime. So I try to sit for anywhere for about 30 minutes, an hour a day. That's my own practice. Of course, I'm a mindfulness meditation instructor. I take it much more seriously than many people. I'm trying to teach those how to be more mindful in their lives and their practice. And that takes another order of skill than just, you know, somebody who was like myself, who just wanted to get some basic tools in hand. Like I was saying earlier, about 5-10 minutes a day is really all you need. Now, as far as things about my personal life, you know, I coach my kids' basketball teams as often as I can. Me and my wife are very close. We spend a lot of our personal time together. But not too far in the past, I snapped my knee on shifts, which is what led to my medical retirement. It was the second time I snapped my right knee. And so that happened on Thanksgiving of 2023. You can imagine why, a bunch of dumb firefighters trying to play football. Nice. Fortunately, I did not walk away from that situation. And I spent all of 2024 learning how to rewalk again and getting several surgeries in order to do that. But, you know, a typical day for me isn't too much different than it would be for any average person. I just try to squeeze in, you know, an hour of mindfulness practice a day. And that could be a 5-minute sit here. It could be 10 minutes while I'm waiting in line to pick up my kids. I'll just try to be as mindful as I can in the car, you know. Mindfulness practice in itself can be done almost anywhere, doing almost anything. At first, it's hard to understand how somebody can be practicing mindfulness and having a conversation. But I've been doing this almost this entire time with you gentlemen as we sit here, you know, trying to engage with this conversation to the best of my ability and avoid things like thirst or fidgeting that come up in my awareness as I'm talking to you. But when you are starting out, what you're trying to do in meditation is be as undistracted as you can. Okay, and that's really what the practice is about, is remaining undistracted. So you'll say, focus on the breath, and you want to remain undistracted from other things and just focus on the breath. Now, this you're not going to be able to do this, okay? You're immediately, within moments, going to be thinking about a conversation you had yesterday or something that you got to do tomorrow, or you'll think of some embarrassing thing you did as a four-year-old and torment
Where's
yourself
my phone?
Over that. Where's my phone? Notifications. Let me pause this meditation and see this text real quick, right? Like, it's impossible to do at first. But once you've practiced a certain amount of mindfulness and you can kind of hone your skills of attention, that's when you can get into the practice of mindfulness meditation a little bit deeper and start to understand body sensations and emotions and thoughts and kind of the complexities that go on with some of that stuff. But early on, in order to stay undistracted, it is helpful to pick the same time of day, same kind of place to do it in. Often closing our eyes at first is a good idea, staying away from large, loud environments. But once you've got a certain amount of mindfulness skill on board, you can, quote, meditate anywhere. You know, I don't know if I said it earlier in the podcast, but the difference between mindfulness and meditation is mindfulness is just a skill. And that skill is the ability to be aware of one's current experience, moment to moment, without judging it in any way, okay? Without putting an ethical tab on whether or not this shirt's comfortable or uncomfortable, whether or not this coffee is too hot, too cold, too sweet, all those ethical judgments. And you're trying to be aware of your moment to moment experience without judging it. Okay. That's what mindfulness is. Meditation is kind of like the gym. It's where you go to practice mindfulness in all of its various forms. Okay. And it's that gym membership of meditation and the type of workout in your practice, quote unquote workout you're doing, whether it's focusing on the breath, focusing on body sensations, standing, walking, eyes open, eyes closed, whatever workout you're doing is all in an effort to practice the skill of mindfulness, so that we can distribute it in our day-to-day lives in a way that's very useful to ourselves, our loved ones, and our communities that we serve as first responders.
Yeah, I love that. And then thanks for explaining that. It's like when, as you're talking, I'm thinking, you know, I have, depending on traffic after work, I have 40, 45 minute drive home. And I've noticed, well, I've intentionally a lot of times turned off the radio and there's a lot of traffic, right? And so, but I've intentionally turned off the radio to where I can just think. I realized real quick it's bad to close my eyes when I do this. but it's so crazy that 40 minute drive, once I get home, how much different I feel. I don't have the stimuli of the radio. And because when I have the stimuli of the radio, I have the stimuli of the traffic and everything else. When I don't have it on and I'm just thinking, I don't really pay attention to the traffic. I don't really pay attention to, you know what I mean? I mean, how busy it is or how long it's taking me to get home. And it's a very, I don't know if peaceful is the right word, but it's a very enjoyable drive home. And I'm much different when I get home after that.
Well, I would highlight that as kind of like a micro experience of the difference between the common modern world for our brains that were evolved on the African savanna and, you know, figured out how to hunt and drink water and populate the earth, right? Okay. Back then, the most interesting part of most of your days was probably, you know, watching a big old bird pass through the sky. You know, there are very few constant attention needing moments, right? In today's society, there's just so much stimulus. There's the traffic that you're dealing with, there's the radio that you're listening to, you're trying to keep up with the lyrics. You know, you're thinking about what you got to do when you get home. You're thinking about your day that you had. You're doing all of this cognitive overhead in your mind. And just turning off the radio itself, just that one, taking away one single stimulus, not only takes away sound from entering your awareness, this ability to try to keep up with the beat and the tone so that it makes sense in our minds, but it also frees up maybe some of the stress that you're coping with as well. As silly as that sounds, I'm not dogging on music, right? But we know through studies that if we're listening to classical jazz or Mozart, or we're listening to Chameleon Air, we're going to be having different mental and emotional experiences just by the music choices we're choosing, right? Yep. And so, you know, nothing to say there's nothing inherently wrong with modern society. I mean, everything about us, we're healthier than we've ever been, you know, we're living longer than we ever have. The average person has more wealth and dispensable resources than we ever have in human society. You know, in today's day and age, you're more likely to die of overeating than undereating for the first time in human history. Like there are so many benefits to modern society. But in the process of doing it, we've kind of lost control of our minds. And then we're getting to a point in modern society where it's getting harder and harder for the average person to keep up with the constant username and passwords, with the constant notifications, with work and school that everybody's involved with now. You know, when I was younger, you're done with school by the time you were 26. That's if you were lucky to get a college degree. You know, by the time I was 23, my supervisors who were in their 50s were still in college seeking these degrees that are just like never ending now. You know, we're all in school until we're dead now, right? When I don't know what happened. You know, there's this constant competing modes for your attention. And what we do is we try to grasp onto them and keep up with them as many as we can. And then you'll grill yourself, you'll crucify yourself over the things that you miss. And they're always the same things. I'm not spending enough time with my kids. I'm not spending enough time with my wife. I'm not spending enough time with my friends or on myself. You know, my health is going away. My happiness is going away. And mindfulness meditation can really, really help you prioritize what is most important. I guarantee every one of your listeners has had the experience, if they have children, of being in the middle of a text message and actually putting their finger up to their child when they say mom or dad and saying, hold on, this is more important than whatever you have to say. And we do that to our kids. And then we wonder why our kids do that to us when they're older. You know, they don't pay attention to us and they just look at their phones. Because we did this to them. And mindfulness is a skill where you really see that this digital thing that I'm looking at, typing on, my child is right here and they have something they want to share with me. And how many more opportunities am I going to have to engage with my kid in this way? I mean, if I'm lucky, my kids will be moved out by the time they're 18, but I don't think that, you know, I think 24 is the standard now. But, you know, even by that age, they don't want to share with you this gold star they got on this meaningless assignment, okay? I know this gold star on this meaningless assignment isn't going to make headlines and it's not going to be that important, but I can make it important to my kid if I give him the gift of my attention and I show him that I see that he did something good. And that moment is worth having. Instead of putting your finger up to your kid, finishing your text, putting it down, oh, that's great. Notification, grabbing your phone again, good job. And then you go right back to your phone.
And how many times do we call that quality time with our with our kids or our wife, right?
Absolutely.
And instead of just putting it away. If I go to my mom's house and visit with my mom, and if I pull that out, my mom will tell me, put it away. When you're here visiting with me, we're just going to visit. She goes, so don't even, and you know what I mean? She will. She's very adamant, like, put that thing away. And
I want to explore something there. I've been trying to formulate how to kind of present this as a discussion point, but there's so much value in what you said about us in our culture and society looking for that next achievable win. The next thing, the next pat on the back, the next, what you're advocating, Josh, is much more long-term and self-care based, which doesn't present the trophy, certainly not in the immediate. I mean, there's 20 years from now, you're going to be really glad you did this. But there's nobody standing there saying, man, you killed that mindfulness today. Like, nailed it, man. That just doesn't exist. So as we're sitting here talking, I just find so much truth in this, seeking this next win, this next validation, this next trophy, this next. And what we're describing and what we're talking about here is something completely different.
Yeah, I'll touch on a little bit of that if you don't mind. I tell people all the time that your brain, basically your mind has two primary functions. The mind that you call you. It's to keep you safe, and that includes everything from running from the lion, the fight or flight response, to finding food, to finding a domestic partner who you could be safe and have shelter and have communion with, right? To keep you safe. But then there's this other mode that the brain does, and that's to keep you somewhat dissatisfied with your everyday experience. And that was very beneficial for survival, okay? Being dissatisfied with your current experience is kind of what we call motivation to go change your hunger, okay? It's kind of motivation to go fix your thirst. It's motivation to care for that wound that hurts and maybe not run on it, okay? You know, keeping you inherently dissatisfied with your experience was very good for survival mechanisms. However, we've all had that experience now in modern days where we get that spouse of our dreams. And we're standing there in front of our loved ones and we're saying the I do's at our wedding. And before we know it, we're frustrated that the cruise that we were going to take got delayed by an hour. The next day when we're going to our honeymoon, we're now frustrated because our cruise was delayed. And it's like, you know, you would think in that moment you finally achieved everything you ever wanted, but you're just on to the next thing. You know, once you get that promotion you want, or that fire helmet, that your color fire helmet you wanted, or that badge that you were looking for, and you're standing up there in front of all your peers feeling like you've accomplished the goal, it begins evaporating in our hands. And why is that? It's because this constant need for your brain to keep you going, keep you constantly dissatisfied with your everyday experience. And mindfulness can help us train against that. It can train against those mechanisms that are, even small experiences are worth having. And it's the attention that you give it that's makes it a valuable experience. You know, what is going to be at the end of your life, what is going to be the cash value of how much you loved your wife or you loved your kids? Well, by definition, it can't be how much money you spent on her or how much money you fed her or how much food you fed her. It's the amount of attention you gave to your wife or your children in either eye contact through conversation, in looking at pictures of them and thinking about the good times, in memories and shared experiences, right? It is by definition the amount of attention you give anything in your life that is going to be, in the end, how much you valued it. And so many of us are living this cloudy, fogged up conscious awareness where we're kind of half in with our family during dinner, kind of thinking about the television show that's going on behind us, kind of thinking about work the next day, kind of, and we're stratifying our awareness and our attention in so many different directions at all times that we really can't just be there with our family. You know, we wait for these 2-week periods where we get a beach towel, we get a plane ticket, and for this week, I could finally be present because I have the ocean in front of me, I have the smell I need to be happy, I have the big drink I need in my hand to be happy, and now I can finally be happy. But why do you have to wait for the world to arrange itself in any specific way for you to be happy? You know, I can be just as happy in this conversation with you gentlemen as I can be visiting, you know, the Egyptian pyramids and seeing those for the first time and being deeply ingrained with human culture, right? I can be just as engaged and just as enjoying this experience as I can be watching my kid play basketball and score that 3-pointer. I mean, who says you can't be? You know, it's only these different definitions that say, well, you have to love your kids more than you love other people's kids. Well, where's that written anywhere? Now, I'm not saying I have gotten to the point where I see all children as equals and every kid. Obviously, I'm going to care and love my kids more. That's where I am on my mindfulness journey. I'm just like most people there. But there are individuals who claim to love everybody's children in the same way they might love their own because they've studied what loving kindness is in the mind. They've fueled it and practiced it over long periods within their meditation practice. And so I have no doubt that there are ways in which you can train certain mechanisms of the mind in order to feel better emotions, in order to have better priorities, just through the own study of your mind, how it's behaving, and the trajectory in which you're trying to get in life.
And it makes me think of the phrase, you know, happiness is a state of mind. It's not a destination. You know, mm-hmm. And a lot of times we're like, I'll be happy when this happens, or I'll be happy when I get this, or I'll be happy, you know, but yeah, it's more of a state of mind.
The other thing that really stood out to me when we talked on the phone, Josh, was the idea of false dispatching and false emergencies. I think you and I were having a discussion about the sympathetic nervous system at the time. Maybe if that's not correct, then, you know, please correct me, but there's something about that concept that really spoke to me. It resonated. I feel like it will with most first responder and veteran listeners out here or their loved ones, because the idea of, you know, this protective mind dispatching us out to something or foreseeing an emergency that is not real or not true. I mean, this is part of this, right? Of helping understand and silence or curb or calm this part of who we are. And so I would love for you to speak to that, because that was so unique the way you unpacked that.
Yeah. So after our conversation, I actually penned out an article that laid out that topic. It's called The World's Worst Dispatcher. You can find it on Foundation Fortified's Instagram or at the Firehouse Tribune, where I write for. You know, it didn't take long in my mindfulness practice before I started to understand something about my mind, okay? And anybody who's ever been a first responder and worked with a great dispatch center or a bad dispatch center or just a poor dispatcher is going to vividly know what I'm talking about here. Okay? To work a shift with a bad dispatcher or a bad dispatch center is really like trying to serve the community with half its resources, right? If this dispatcher is just utilizing resources that are not necessary or not sending you to the most important traffic calls, you know, you can actually begin to see your 911 system begin to get clogged up on calls and traffic just because the dispatcher isn't keeping the chessboard as open and set up as well to respond to Murphy's next move, right? Well, I find that same mechanism in my head. Okay. It's like I live with the world's worst dispatcher in my head sometimes. And it's constantly sending me to false emergencies, right? Whether that false emergency, like I was saying earlier, is hearing my kid thud to the ground. And instead of just recognizing, most likely it's just my kid tripping over his feet that are growing because he's 12 years old and growing faster than a weed. You know, I'm imagining a plane just hit him and I'm going to walk outside. I'm going to see my kid obliterate all over the road or whatever, you know, and my mind is just sending me to this false imaginary dispatch. And here I am responding to it. And I can't even, you know, in my fire truck, I can go responding. But in my head, I just find myself getting up and rushing out to see if he's okay. All right. And I do this all the time. I'll be constantly anxious about anything that's going on. And I'll have to get up to go see what's going on there. And we're all living with the world's worst dispatcher in our heads that's constantly inventing false emergencies for you, constantly inventing false conversations that you're rehearsing and rehashing in your head and reshaping just to get to that conversation the next day. And it'd be fairly easy and not that consequential. And the other person was actually much nicer about the apology you were going to give them than you were expecting them to, you know? But you spent an entire afternoon working yourself up over that situation. And just responding to a false emergency that entire time. And we're always doing this to ourselves. And what mindfulness meditation can do is begin to help you become more sensitive to the emergencies that actually demand and require your attention and the ones that maybe don't. You know, my assistant chief one time gave me a very useful tool that I now use in my day-to-day life as well. I was struggling as a new captain, not knowing how to influence a scene as well as maybe a more seasoned one would. And after a particularly difficult call where several people died and I was, you know, really racking up whether or not I should have gotten more ambulances sooner or later and, you know, doing this whole thing as we do, you know, my assistant chief pulled me aside and he says, you know, something that I do when I get on a difficult call and I'm not sure what to do. I said, no, tell me. And he goes, I first ask myself what happens if I do nothing. What happens if I don't do a single thing on the scene? And he said, what can be very helpful with that is instead of thinking of ways in which you need to act, it gives you a moment to think, what's going to happen if I don't? And then the priorities can really start stacking up. You know, maybe the fire isn't as important as the propane against the fire. You know, maybe the propane against the fire isn't as important as the kid that's passed out next to it, right? Like you begin to see these ever serious emergencies within the emergency if you just ask, what happens if I do nothing? And that's a big mechanism of what mindfulness practice is. It's having responses within the mind while you're sitting on the cushion and not responding to them in the same way that you would in your day-to-day life. You're just noticing them come online. You're just noticing this response of the mind, response of the body, the physiological response, the thoughts that are associated, how all of that is playing out in your awareness. And then once you've done this for a certain amount of time, you're able to do it in real time. So when a coworker of yours comes at you with a finger in the face and is discharging something that you may or may not have done right there in front of all of your peers, you don't have to respond to that situation the same way that you might normally. You know, there's no need to take it personal. There's no need to defend your honor in front of your peers in the same way. There's no need to take offense to what's going on. There's just a need to understand what the confusion is and to seek the best path forward for resolving the conflict without all the unnecessary baggage that we usually bring to it. And that's kind of how I see that, you know, this false dispatcher that we all live with in our heads, just constantly giving us real emergencies to go to. Sure, she gets one right every now and then, but the vast majority of them are just terribly, terribly dispatched. They're terribly foretold, and I end up just wasting a bunch of time and resources on these things that just truly, in the end, don't matter.
On a personal level, the consequences of that false dispatching are pretty negative. that permeate into our personal lives, which is, you know, the opposite of the benefits of, you know, bad health, bad sleep, you know, drinking, anxiety, anxiousness, depression. I mean, that's bad relationships. Suicidal ideation. You know, now you're starting to see yourself as a failure. And I mean, it is compounding. I just found that part of our conversation on the phone very fascinating and spent a lot of time reflecting on it. As a matter of fact, I was telling Max before we started, I said, listen, I want this to come up at some point because this is so fascinating part of the way of looking at how we live a life of anxiousness, if not hypervigilance, of seeing things that aren't there, or, you know, seeing something differently than what is true, and how much that has a negative impact on us. So, thanks for sharing that. As we kind of wrap up, let's make sure for the listeners, I know you did a great job of describing mindfulness and the difference between mindfulness and meditation, but speak to the listeners about an actual meditation. I don't think, you know, doing an actual meditation on here is probably practical, but what does that look like both in action and mind frame? Can you walk us through a meditation and the nuances of it?
Absolutely. That sounds great. I'll take it from a basic person who's either never sat or only sat in a meditation once just to begrudgingly get through it, right? When you first start sitting in meditation, you're going to come at it with a bunch of expectations and a bunch of hopes and some curiosity about what you're going to be doing there. And the first most important goal of my meditation is understand that what you're not trying to do something. You're trying to not do things that you normally do in your mind, okay? You feel anger, you attach to that anger, you start telling yourself a story about that anger, and then you discharge it back into the world and make that anger actually salient for the other people around you, okay? Meditation practice, you're trying to get ahead of that anger in probably 1,000 different ways. As you begin to practice more and more, you see there's almost 1,000 different ways you can stop that process from happening. First, you can notice that my chest feels a little warm, and then that passes away, right? You notice that your hands feel a little hot. Maybe your face starts to get flushed, okay? Those are all body sensations that you can notice if you pay close enough attention to it. And that begins to take away the edge of anger already, okay? And then you can notice the story you begin telling yourself. And that's where we start to attach ourselves to this anger, okay? That's my friend. Why did he hit me? He shouldn't have hit me. My face hurts, you know? I thought we were friends. You know, what I do to deserve this? And you start attaching a story to it, okay? So in a meditation practice, it's important to recognize you're not trying to achieve any goal. You're just simply trying to remain undistracted the entire time. And what helps initially is to be given something to focus on, which is why the breath is so common, okay? There are three separate types of practices I would suggest to your listener. There are focused attention practices, and that's typically the starting point, right? Focus on the breath, focus on sounds, focus on body sensations, whatever it is. And the goal is to try to focus on whatever that stimulus is. And anytime you notice that you've come off of that project and you start to time travel within the mind or tell yourself a story, you notice you've become distracted. Don't get frustrated with that experience. It's going to happen. And just come back to the breath. Now, every time you do this, it's like a bicep curl for your mind. It's like a repetition of muscle tissue. You're training that attention to just keep coming back. And it doesn't take too long, you know, a couple sessions, maybe 10, before you begin to strengthen that attention a little bit. You'll notice that you can actually follow the breath for maybe 3 or 4 cycles, not just half a cycle, you know, and that can begin to grow in time, okay? There's also open awareness practices. All right, now this is after we've gotten a little bit of attention on board. We can kind of understand what it's like to just be aware without having to attached to anything to be aware of it. You just kind of remain open in your meditation practice and notice maybe it's a sound that comes through conscious awareness. Maybe it's the temperature in the room comes through conscious awareness, or you begin to smell something in the environment, or you notice body sensations, right? This is where we don't have any particular goal of focusing. What we're trying to do is focus on whatever's coming into our awareness at any given time. So that's kind of the distinction between those two. You got focused attention practice, open awareness practice. And then there's acceptance practices. And this is where we'll start to talk about things like, you know, the earth-shattering term of loving kindness that I've used earlier. You know, I remember the first time I heard loving kindness as a term, I like I shivered away from it because it sounded so goofy. But loving kindness is just another type of acceptance practice. And this is where the rubber can really meet the road when it comes to the benefits of mindfulness meditation. Is as mammals, as primates, we're always trying to control our environment. We have the gift of movement because we have feet and we have hands, and we have needs, right? Food, relationships, water, you know, so we constantly move to go get those things. All right. And inherently in doing that over the course of, you know, 30 years in your lifetime or whatever, you think you have to do things to achieve certain outcomes. You have to do it. But if, as silly as it sounds like, if you compare yourself to a tree for a moment, all right, a tree is stuck in its environment and it has to trust everything around it that it's going to get that water, that it's going to get that sunlight that it needs, that it's going to get. It's not going to be hacked down by some human who needs some firewood, right? This tree is completely beholden to its environment. And it doesn't have to do anything to grow twice as big and 200 feet tall, you know? But we feel like we have to control our environments. So we're more like squirrels who are constantly running around arranging things in order to make them satisfactory to us. And acceptance practice can kind of show us that we have a lot more in common with that tree than we think we do, okay? I trust a lot of people in my day-to-day environment in order to get things done. You know, I trust that my city roads are going to be drivable. I trust the water department to make sure that my water is going to be clean and pressurized to the degree that I need to take a shower, right? I trust the police department to keep my kids safe while they're at school. I trust that the banks are going to give me the money that they say that I have in them. There are literally thousands of people that we all trust day-to-day. But we feel like we're the only ones that get things done for ourselves. And acceptance practices can kind of open you up to how much of a delusion that really is, ultimately, and how much you can just accept things for as they are. It doesn't say anything about you might not want to actually go get that promotion. Absolutely. You know, we still, in the mindfulness community, part of self-compassion is goal achievement and getting the things that you want. But we don't have to suffer the consequences if we fail to achieve the goals that we imagined for ourselves. Does that make sense? Yeah. Not achieving a goal that you imagined you were going to achieve. Well, that's a lot like a four-year-old getting mad because their imaginary friend called them a name. You know, you just imagined something was going to happen and it didn't. And now you're upset about it. That isn't very self-compassionate. Okay. So there's nothing saying that we don't want to influence our environment and go achieve the things that we want. We just have a better relationship to accepting when things don't go the way that we want, or we don't achieve the outcomes that we imagine for ourselves. Okay. And we can just understand that life, we're on a continuum throughout our experience in our life. And it really is more about a journey than a destination. And that's a little bit about what acceptance practice will do for you. So that's kind of the three modes in which you'll find different kinds of practices. And they're, again, are thousands of ways to play with the mind.
And so again, for myself, I've not done much meditation, and for any of our listeners. So what does that look like? If I'm going to start meditation, I'm going to do this tomorrow morning. Am I sitting on the couch? Am I laying on the living room floor? Am I sitting at a kitchen table? What's the right way to do this is my question.
Good question. So again, going back to just beginner status, you know, it's very helpful to just be in a sitting posture, okay? And the way that we first talk about sitting postures and meditation is, you know, we all have that classic lotus position where people are, you know, putting their fingers in weird patterns and, you know, cross-legged. You know, there's nothing, fine, sit that way. But you don't have to sit that way. You know, a chair works just fine. You know, if you want your back supported, that's perfectly fine. But it does help to have a dignified posture where your core somewhat engaged, not tight, but engaged, and you're kind of keeping your spine up. This helps to maintain your awareness, okay? You know, if we're slumped over and we're trying to meditate, you know, the tendency is to begin to fall asleep. You know, one of the things that happens during meditation is our brainwaves change, you know, and I'm not going to get into the science of that, but you go from more alert brainwaves to kind of some subdued ones, you know, and we kind of try to hover in between this area, and that's kind of where we find our mindfulness practice is really beneficial at. You can almost feel it when it happens. You don't necessarily need to hook yourself up to an EKG, but it helps to be in a good posture, okay? And once you've obtained that posture, you might want to seek some guided meditation at first. You know, it's helpful to have somebody in your ear reminding you of the goal and reminding you of the stimulus on occasion. just to kind of keep you, if you do find yourself mind wandering about something you did in third grade for 5 minutes. And every now and then it's good to have somebody remind you, oh yeah, let's just focus on the breath, come back here, right? So good posture, having a good guided meditation instructor will be beneficial to you at first. But thereafter, once you've gained a certain amount of mindfulness skill and you've practiced mindfulness for a little while, you can lay down, you can walk. You know, there's standing meditation, there's walking meditation, there's sleep meditation. And the goal is to calm you down and get you into a very deep level sleep, right? There's almost any way that you can begin to be mindful. But again, at first, it's helpful to, just like anything else with humans, create a certain conditions for you so you can get into it. You know, that's why we send our recruits to academies when we first hire them. We send them to a place where they can get paid to make mistakes for, you know, however many months. So we create the conditions for learning, right? So we kind of want to do that early on our meditation practice. And, you know, at Foundation Fortified, I try to walk it out for everybody so that when you're, there are two free sections out there. There's building the habit and there's training attention are the two free sections I have out there on my free side. And there's a couple of the, you know, there's a sleep meditation, there's a supporter meditation for wives, husbands, or kids. And I believe there's a sleep one. I think I might have said that. But anyway, when I walk you through each different section throughout my course, I kind of help guide you in an initial intro on what you're trying to achieve. And then each practice kind of has a little bit of that assistance throughout it.
That's awesome. Thank you.
And you just led right into it as we kind of wrap up here. I want to give you the opportunity to just to talk about your platform here. And you just started doing that. You offer up some free, but it's pretty extensive. You want to talk about your Foundation Fortified and what that is and what you offer to this community?
Absolutely. So I built Foundation Fortified as kind of the mindfulness platform that first responders can go to understand meditation and mindfulness, practice developing your attention, kind of begin to get into loving kindness and trauma practices, and just kind of be the meditation mindfulness hub for first responders. Okay, that's what it is. I have a free site out there for basically anybody. You don't have to be a first responder to seek out the content. But if you are a first responder, you're going to notice me using different language, things that you might have experienced throughout your career to try to get at these concepts in a very deliberate way for first responders. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense? But I have a free side because, you know, I want to see this stuff being given out to recruits and academies, if I'm being completely honest. There's going to come a day where I hope to find myself at police conferences and fire conferences and EMS conferences and talking about why mindfulness meditation is the thing that's missing from our industry. Okay, these days, we know when we hire this beautiful young 18-year-old person who wants to serve their community, we know what you're going to see. We might not know exactly the flavor, you know, it might be worse than our chief has ever seen, you know. My guys at my previous department, they ran a hot air balloon accident in about a year and a half ago that was probably the most horrific story I'd ever heard in my life. And I couldn't believe that the guys had to respond to that kind of a call. You know, it was a hot air balloon accident. And it was just a grisly situation, right? Well, I might not have seen that, but I've seen plenty of other things. We know this about 18-year-olds when we hire them. So we should be training them from an early age about their minds, about how they cope with trauma, about what it feels like in their own, in the privacy of their own minds and bodies, trauma and stress and anxiety and things like that, to kind of get a little bit of data on ourselves. And it'll also help prevent mental health issues from coming up. These days, we just wait for you to develop the mental health issues that we all know you're going to have, and then we treat them. But the same way we developed physical fitness as an important platitude in our industry, the same way we're trying to get ahead of cancer by making sure that there are cancer preventative measures that we take day to day in the fire service, we're trying to get ahead of these things. We're trying to prevent them. And mindfulness meditation is the best way humans have come up with of preventing mental health issues. So I think first responders need to be given this practice a little bit in their recruit academies. And that's in large part why I have the free side. I mean, the average police RTO probably won't be able to, after yelling and getting them to do push-ups, you know, have them focus on their breath and do all that. But you can certainly hit play on Foundation Fortified and, you know, have your group practice these 16 meditations that I have throughout your training. And then on the subscriber side, that for the rest of the year, 2024 or 2025 is going to be, I think, a whopping $25 annually. If you sign up, I don't ever intend to raise your rate. That's not what I'm going to do, but I might raise my rates here come next year. But on the subscriber side, you have a section called Understanding Practice. You have a section called Loving Kindness. You have a section called Trauma. We have a section for body sensations, sleep meditations, supporter meditations. And I plan on continuing to grow. I plan on continuing to put more content on there. I want to have a veteran side at some point. I'm not a veteran myself, so I feel very hesitant about trying to teach meditation to veterans. But I'm hoping to talk to enough or maybe find a veteran who's interested in meditation, get him certified so that maybe he or she can develop some. So we'll
see
where that goes.
Shout out to any listeners out there you on your behalf. If they're veteran meditators, then get a hold of Josh. Yeah.
Absolutely. So yeah, I mean, that's what you can find on the subscriber side is just everything meditation and mindfulness that I've put out so far.
Where do people find that? Where's your website?
Foundationfortified.org. Perfect.
And then social media, how do people find you?
I have an Instagram, I have a Facebook page. I haven't gotten into the TikTok world yet. You know, that might be a few years beyond me at this point, but I have those two platforms that I try to post to regularly. I host the Midweek Mindfulness on the Thin Line Rock Station. For your listeners that don't know, the Thin Line Rock Station is a rock station built by first responders for first responders. You can type them into Google and it's an internet radio station that you can just download to your phone and listen whenever you want. I host Midweek Mindfulness there every Wednesday at noon Eastern time. So you can listen to me there. And you can also see some of my writing in the Firehouse Tribune. So that's kind of the ways I've made it so far. I'm hoping to start writing my first book here in the near future.
Did you write those down, Brad?
I've never heard of Thin Line Rock Station.
I'll get it from you.
That is, I'm gonna look that up for sure. Yeah.
Yeah, it's cool. It's a cool group of guys, man. They're doing cool things over there, and they're growing and growing and growing. They saw me on social media, and I can't remember who reached out to who, but they offered me some time on the radio every week, and so
man, that's super
I took
awesome.
It Midweek Mindfulness.
Well, Josh, this has been a really fascinating conversation, and I had no doubt that this was going to be great, and you obviously lived up to that. So thank you so much for coming on the podcast and sharing something that you're obviously very passionate about. And we will, with that, we'll sign off. We'll see you guys soon.
Thanks, Josh.
Thank you.
Chateau Health and Wellness is a 16-bed treatment facility nestled in the foothills of the Wasatch Mountains in Midway, Utah. Chateau's First Responder Resiliency Program is designed to treat the unique challenges and issues that first responders encounter in the course of their careers. Chateau's comprehensive and highly individualized approach to treatment addresses more than just the presenting issues. It addresses the why. Each of their seasoned, trauma-trained, and culturally competent therapists utilize evidence-based, specialized therapies to treat trauma at its core and enable clients to begin the healing process while developing a resilient and healthy relationship with stress. Chateau Health and Wellness is trusted by departments and agencies from around the country to treat responders and veterans. In fact, it is one of only a handful of facilities nationwide that is vetted and approved to treat members of the Fraternal Order of Police. For more information or to speak to a representative, go to chateaurecovery.com or call 888-507-5031.